Good morning, world travelers and diners. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, and good afternoon to all our listeners in Australia. Good day to people who are about to get up in the morning.
You're buttering up all our friends in Australia, because that's where we're going next.
Buttering up the people in Europe, and good morning to Michael Ruhlman, who's in Cleveland, so he's in the same time zone as we are, and getting up early on Sunday morning to do On the Menu business. Michael, great to hear from you this morning, and I'm going to hand this over to Anne because she absolutely adores your book. She's one of your biggest fans.
Well, both of you, thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, you know, I never asked you this question before I get into the discussion of the book. You have 12 books out, including co-authoring of really significant, like The French Laundry, and you wrote The Making of a Chef, and you write for all the New York Times and Gourmet and so forth. How do you do that from Cleveland?
it's a trick to do this from Cleveland. I do it because, well, the serious answer is I do it because travel is so easy, because the internet gives us access to all kinds of information we didn't used to have. So New York is not the food central.
Yeah, I understand that because I operate out of Pittsburgh. But
there you go.
We run On the Menu out of Pittsburgh, which is.
But you seem to hang around more with some of these people. Like, you kind of hang out with Tony Bourdain and Eric Repair. So you must be in New York a lot.
I do. And it's very easy, as you know, I'm sure it is for you, to pop into New York. It's an hour flight, and it's not very expensive.
Yeah, but Eric is not inviting me to have drinks with him.
That's a shame, because he's a lovely man.
Isn't he adorable? Yes, indeed.
He's a wonderful cook and a wonderful chef.
You know, one of the great things about him, Michael, also, is the way the place functions like clockwork when he's not there.
That's the mark, really, of a great chef.
Yeah, that's the mark of a. The last time we were there, the maitre d' who took care of us was Ecuadorian. Although he was beautiful, impeccably dressed, as you would expect at Le Bernardin. And I was betting that probably he started out washing dishes in the kitchen. Uh-huh. And I thought it was a tremendous tribute to Eric that he allowed all members of his staff to have the opportunity to grow with the organization. And that's one of the reasons it's been so successful, I'm sure.
Yes, indeed.
Well, let's get to your book now, which is The Elements of Cooking. And for those who are unfortunate enough not to have been exposed to the sort of ideological model of this, The Elements of Style, I would like to mention that. And I told you off air that as soon as I got the announcement of your book, I ran and found my absolutely ancient copy of The Elements of Style by Strunk and White on the bookshelf where it has always sat.
Well, it's a great, great book, and everybody should read it, period.
I mean, it's just the basics of how to write.
You mean everyone should read The Elements of Style?
Yes, they should.
It's very clear that they don't. There are certain segments of the population who probably should have their own copy written.
absolutely.
If you get by drift.
So now that inspired you, because I guess there's a similar situation in the world of cooking. Everybody's doing it, and I would say probably 2/3 of the people doing it have not a clue what they're doing. Is that what inspired you?
Well, it's partly what inspired me. I was looking, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. I wanted to keep writing about food. And so my wife said to me, Michael, why don't you write that, you spent all this time with these great chefs, and you learned to cook at the CIA, and, you spent all this time in professional kitchens. Why don't you just write the 10 most important things a cook needs to know? And I thought that was sort of an intriguing idea, and that was just in the back of my mind. And I was preparing for a class, I was doing some sort of English seminar at Chautauqua, and I was going through this book, and The Elements of Style, just reading it for a general writing course, I thought, oh my God, this is exactly what I want to do for the kitchen.
Yes.
I want to create an opinionated glossary of cooking terms that you need to know. I want to write about those 10 most important things.
You actually do 8, do you not?
I wrote 8 essays, yes.
And I just want to interject here that your writing appears to be just so easy coming from you, but it's just so concise and elegant and approachable. And it just makes a lot of sense. And I always enjoy reading your books.
Well, thank you, Anne.
but you teach writing as well, right? So you're not just involved with the world of cooking. You started out as a teacher of the English language and how to write.
No, I actually started out as a copy boy at the New York Times. I've always been a writer.
Okay.
And for most of my years, I've been a freelance writer. I taught at Case Western Reserve for a semester. I don't think I'm a very good teacher or a confident teacher. I don't. It just doesn't fit.
I can't teach either.
I'd rather listen to people than talk to people, and that's kind of what I do. I go around and gather information. So I've written about pediatric heart surgery and
wooden
boats,
right?
And non-food subjects, which helps me stay fresher in the food world, yeah. I think.
Now, you start out and you have these eight wonderful essays, and the categories are stocks, sauce, salt, the egg, etc. Mm-hmm. And then the second half of the book is a glossary of terms, mm-hmm, that everyone should know. Let's just run through some of the... Let's start with stocks. You're very passionate about stocks.
I am indeed. I think that if there's one thing that separates the home cook's food from the professional restaurants, the professional chef's food, it's homemade stock. It's fresh stock. It's not very hard to make, and it really transforms all of your cooking. So if we just knew to make stock more a part of our cooking, then our cooking would get better. The canned broths that are available are loaded with salt. They're not very good.
Right.
You can make them taste okay by adding other aromats and onions and thyme and carrots and stuff. But, you know, why not make your own stock if you're going to go to that trouble? I think people have got the wrong idea about stock. They think that stock is this big production that requiring gigantic vessels and tons of bones and hours and hours and hours of cooking and straining and skimming. Well, all you need is a little pot and a few bones and an onion and a carrot. You've got some delicious stock. So I think we've made it too difficult.
It's really funny. Oh. We have a friend who's in the healthcare business, Clyde Jones, who prides himself, however, on making veal stock in huge quantity.
He loves process. In fact, I did a whole profile of him saying that he was a lover of the process, and that's what he likes to do.
Well, you know, that's the kind of person I would want cooking for me.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, your essay is like almost poetic about the glorifying veal stock.
Yeah, I get kind of fanatical about that.
Yeah. And nobody does make it anymore, do they?
They don't. And, you know, it's just this wonderful, amazing... It's a stock like no other. I mean, fish stock tastes like fish. Beef stock tastes like beef. Pork stock tastes like pork. And chicken stock tastes like chicken. Veal stock doesn't really taste like anything that you could put your finger on. It's more just savory. It gives everything that sort of umami, brothy, depth, complexity, because it's got so much gelatin in it.
Well, you think part of it also is to do with the fact that veal as a meat really doesn't have very much taste?
Well, I think, you know...
I mean, it's extraordinarily mild as a meat.
It's very mild, and that's the whole point, you know. It's from a cow that hasn't really worked its muscles, and it's young, so it's got a lot of connective tissue and not a lot of flavor on its own, so it carries other flavors extremely well.
Yeah, it's also expensive, I imagine. A lot of people don't do veal anymore.
I found a sauce for veal stew. So while I was laid up, I made veal stew several times, and we ate it for like 5 days at once. And on day five, it was better than it was on day one.
Well, yeah, fortunately, at the time, I had very little appetite. Excuse me.
I made it in very large quantities.
Now, two questions I had about your essay on stocks is, in one, you say that if you're going to be using stock throughout the week, mm-hmm, you could just leave it on the stove, the pot.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is, you said that if it's really well frozen, you can keep it up to 2 months. Now, I had I don't know if you ever heard of the French Market in Washington, D.C., but they were all these French guys, and they told me that any time you made and froze stock, you had to take it, thaw it, and boil it up every 2 months.
You had to what?
Yeah, you had to re-boil it up every 2 months. If you had it in your freezer.
Why?
What else do you need to know?
But you said that frozen well in the freezer, you can only go for 2 months because it begins to pick up other flavors.
Yeah, it's not a health. It's not really a health factor. It just doesn't taste as good. You can keep it in there for a year if you want, but it's gonna taste a little funky.
What about leaving it on the stove though in a pot?
What's going to happen to it?
Can it pick up bacteria out of the air?
Sure, bacteria certainly will fall into it. You're breathing bacteria all the time.
It won't spoil.
Well, it would spoil if you left it there for a couple weeks and never touched it. But you know, if you just sort of, you know, I for instance, how I would do it is I'd roast a chicken on Monday night and I'd put the bones in a pot and bring it up to a simmer and then turn it off, and the next day I might finish it, or even the day after that finish it. The bacteria that causes spoilage won't really begin to take hold for several days. So as long as you bring it up to a simmer once a day or once every other day, it'll be fine.
I remember my friend Aviva's father used to keep this chicken soup thing going, and every so often throw in a big hunk of schmaltz. It was just pretty awful.
That's a good way to do it. We need more schmaltz in this world as well.
Exactly.
I guess, Michael, in the professional kitchen, they do exactly what you describe, right? They make huge pots. They make huge pots of stock, and they do leave them on the stove.
They do, but, you know, a restaurant would always store its stocks. A restaurant needs to pay more attention to health.
Oh, okay, all right.
It'd be illegal from a
health department.
HACCP
standard. The health department would get them on HACCP violation.
But they would store them, but they wouldn't freeze them, right?
Exactly. They would go through them too quickly to need to freeze them. You know, but the point is, it will be better if you chill it immediately and quickly and keep it stored in your refrigerator. It'll taste better. I'm just talking about from a practical standpoint of the home cook and making things easier without compromising the quality of the food. There's no reason why you can't leave a stock on the stove overnight.
Yeah. Okay, now you go through stocks. I'm not going to hit on those. I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory. But I was absolutely intrigued because this is one of my big issues, is salt.
It's
the most important thing about cooking. Is being able to salt. You have so many good tips there. Could you give us some of those tips?
One is to salt your food throughout your cooking. If a recipe tells you to sweat onions, say, for a stew that you're making, it's not a bad idea to salt your onions while they're sweating them, just a little bit. You know, just to get the flavors coming out, to get the moisture also start getting it out. So salt throughout the cooking process. You don't want to taste salt in your food. If you taste the salt, it's too salty. Mm-hmm. You want something to be perfectly seasoned.
Who was that chef? It was the one in Parallel something?
There are actually two. We met a lady chef at a restaurant called Parallel 33 in San Diego. Anne likes to ask, when she runs out of questions, she says, what's your favorite ingredient? And so this lady's name, of course, escapes me at the moment, said salt. The other person who said exactly the same thing, salt, is your old friend Thomas Keller. I interviewed him when he was here in Pittsburgh, and as you can imagine he would do after I asked him that question, he took a few seconds, because he's very deliberate and about what he does.
Thoughtful.
He said salt as well.
But it's the hardest thing to teach people, the chef in San Diego said, is when she gets young cooks in the kitchen, to teach them about salt is probably the most important thing she could do.
Well, the most revealing thing that came out of that interview, and this didn't come up when I... No, I think I might have brought it up when I talked to Thomas, but you asked her, can you smell salt?
Yeah, and I can smell salt.
And she said yes, and Anne said, I can too. And I think Thomas said the same thing, but I'm not certain. I don't recall the interview all that well. What's he like, by the way? You must have spent a lot of time with him. We spent a short amount of time with him, and you don't really get to know him.
He's probably very much the way you would expect him to be, judging from what you know, even the little time you spent. He's very, as you said, very deliberate, very thoughtful. He's a very gracious man, a very loyal person. He's the most observant cook that I've encountered. He really pays attention to not only the food and the cooking of it, but the whole world around him. He's just very aware.
Right. I asked him about what you said about him when Presse opened in New York, about losing his shoes.
Uh-huh.
And he answered the question, but I don't think the answer was quite the answer that you intended.
You asked him if he found his shoes.
Yeah, I mean, I asked him if he found his shoes yet, and he explained what it was about, but I think you had something slightly different in mind.
Well, I had it been more of a metaphorical.
That's what
that, that's exactly what I thought.
Now, moving on here, here's another one of my favorites. I think you and I have come down to the same side of these issues. The egg is fabulous. And you say your reverence for the egg borders on religious devotion. There's something in here in this egg section that I had never thought of that's so beautiful. The balance between the egg white, which creates miniature air bubbles when it's beat, whipped, and the egg yolk, which actually separates what oil into little droplets.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's beautiful.
Did I say that?
Yes, you did. And it's poetry, absolute poetry,
well,
Michael.
Well, thank you. I don't even remember that, but that's very nice. That is a nice image. I'm glad I thought of it.
Have you seen that fabulous book that was produced in France called Egg?
The Egg.
I
think it's just called Egg. I don't think it's called
Egg. Oh, no, it's just
Egg.
Called Egg. It's a beautiful book, and it has contributions by everybody from Michel Roux to Wiley Dufresne on eggs and a recipe.
No, I haven't, but I'm no doubt
who's
there
the publisher?
10 volumes of that.
I think it's Flammarion.
Flammarion, which was
Rizzoli, I think. And he just has the one-word title, Egg. And when we asked them for a copy, they said, well, you know the people who wrote it are in Paris. I said, well, that's okay. We'll catch up with them there. And undoubtedly we will.
What else would you like to say? The egg is like a complete food.
Well, yeah, the egg is a sort of a little miracle. I mean, and it's common. It's inexpensive. It's nutritious. It's satisfying. It can be used as a tool. It can be served as a dish on its own. There's just so many things.
You know, you can paint with it. I mean, I took a course in art techniques, and we made egg tempura paint.
Really?
Yeah, it binds the pigment.
Oh, interesting.
It can also get the smell if it's sitting in a little dish too long.
But listen, I'm going to let you into a little secret. Co-host Miss Anne loves soft-boiled eggs for breakfast. We call them eggy weggies, and I fix them for her. And while we tasted Wiley Dufresne's 52-minute egg, we also came up with the answer that it's not really a 52-minute egg. It's just a coddled egg cooked a little bit longer.
Well, yeah, it is. And the temperature really does affect it. It's fascinating what you can do by strictly monitoring low temperatures and cooking
the
egg.
What gives it such odd chemical properties, the egg? I mean, it's very odd, isn't it?
Well, it's amazing. It's a complex little system there with the proteins and the fats and the waters. And the water and other stuff. I think we'd need to go to Harold McGee. For a thorough description.
Well, no, I mean, from a biological standpoint, it's very clear. I mean, it was designed to be the perfect food for whatever little baby bird was growing up in the middle of it.
There you go.
So it just makes sense. I can't understand why you guys didn't figure that out.
Okay, we move on to heat, which you say is dry, moist, and a combination. Uh-huh. But you also add in poaching, sous vide, which is, of course, very timely, and curing, which you have a whole book on that called charcuterie.
Correct.
Yeah, I wanted to be allowed to make your duck charcuterie, and Anne wouldn't let me.
No. Oh, why not?
She said you might...
Not with the germs in our basement.
She said you might kill us. I said, it seems to me like it's so simple.
Oh, it is so simple. I just did one the other day.
In fact, we had the other author of your book on the program.
Oh, did you? Oh, good. Brian Polson.
Yeah, we had Brian on. That's how come I knew so much.
Well, you must do it. It's so simple. It's a perfect time of year to do it. And no, you won't kill anybody.
Okay. Well, I'll let him do it. Okay, then we move on to tools.
You'll hide the book. I know what you'll do. I know what you'll do. You'll hide the book that has the recipe in it.
You have hot five items. You could take five items and equip your whole kitchen.
Well, the point was to pare down to the absolute essentials. We've become so so, you know, gadget obsessed and tool. We've made a fetish of kitchen appliances and tools.
Like an avocado pitter.
Yeah. I mean, that's just ridiculous. All those tools that just do one thing. Those are, you know, chefs would be embarrassed to have those in their own kitchen. Basically, we need.
Actually, you know what I do use? My son, after all these years, he's 30 years of age. He bought me a cherry pitter, and I use it.
Well, if you do a lot of cherries, then it definitely makes the work easier.
I never thought I needed a cherry pitter.
Yeah, well, you don't eat them, but I eat them, and I don't like pits.
Well, I don't have to have them pitted before I eat them. I can
myself.
Bing
cherries.
She has to pit them for me, though. I won't eat them if they're not pitted.
So, but you have, what are your five essential items? Knives?
A knife, a sturdy cutting board, a cooking surface, like a big heavy saute pan, something to cook in the oven with, such as a big Pyrex bowl, and a wooden spoon.
Why did you say a flat wooden spoon? Because you can also use it as a spatula.
Oh, you can use it as a spatula, and I like it because because it keeps things from sticking to the bottoms of a pan. You can get into the corners of a pan if you're cooking anything with that might stick, if any sauce has flour in it or a stew that might be sticking. Or a risotto wood is just a nice material.
Then you move on to, and you have other, of course, for specialized tasks, and especially you mentioned that the pastry chef needs to have more tools than that, and including mm-hmm. a scale. In your sources and acknowledgments, you list 15 books, and your choice is sometimes predictable, and sometimes I consider fairly eccentric.
Well, yes. I would say eccentric. Of course, this was always meant to be a personal book and an opinionated one, mm-hmm. And that necessarily will be eccentric.
And then the hardest to discuss, actually, in a brief radio interview is finesse, which is, do you have a concise definition of what you mean?
Yeah, the definition is refinement and delicacy of performance or execution. But it's got bigger philosophical implications. When I talk with Thomas, this really comes about from working with Thomas, who really cares about finesse and those little things that elevate something to, you know, from excellent to just above excellence. We always talk about the finesse elements of recipes. What are the critical points that make something excellent versus just good? And I think we sort of need to pay attention to the finesse elements in all our doings, in all of life, because it will make life better and will make our performances better, and it will, you know, people will be more happy if they pay attention to the finesse involved in everyday life.
I agree. And next up is AZ Glossary with some surprising terms, including touch. And I just want to conclude by saying that the readers really should get this. If you just want to sit down and read it, you're going to enjoy it, called The Elements of Cooking, Translating the Chef's Craft for Every Kitchen, so it's meant for home cooks. And the author is Michael Ruhlman, with an introduction by Anthony Bourdain. Next up, I understand you're working on ratios?
Cooking from ratios. Cooking, paying attention to the proportions of basic ingredients to understand how food really works.
Well, and it's a nice counterbalance to Harold McGee's book, which I adore also, by the way.
I do too.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a different way of expressing some of the similar ideas.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, Michael, come back and see us, or maybe better still, we'll come and see you in Cleveland, and we'll catch up with that rascal Michael Simon, and we'll catch him as well.
Yeah,
we could have a good time. It only takes us 2.5 hours to get there.
Well, you
sake.
Should do that indeed.
So, okay. Thank you.
We'll wait till the snow stops flying, and then we'll get in touch.
Good idea. Thank you so much for having
good
me.
Good luck
on the
with
show.
Your book, and anybody can go on www.onthemenuradio.com, OTM bookshelf, click on and purchase your book.
Wonderful.
Okay, so bye-bye now.
Thanks so much, you two. Bye-bye.
Thanks. It's time now to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're jumping around the globe here.
Before we jump around the globe, let's remind listeners that they can, of course, check everything that we're doing at the various parts of the website, www.onthemenuradio.com, and send us email at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. That's my little good housekeeping
The
day.
That's good.
But we have our next guest already. Go ahead.
We do. Aficio Farris. Is it Farris?
Perfect. How are you? Come on, say.
Yes, and Aficio is a chef, and he was born in Sardinia.
Okay.
And he has two restaurants, Arco d'Oro, which is Golden Arch, in Houston and one in Dallas.
Not to be confused with the Golden Arches of McDonald's. although perhaps is that where you got the idea from?
My arch actually is an arch of gold and doesn't shine that much.
And also he has, also mention, he imports fabulous Sardinian products, because I looked on your list of products available, and most importantly, we have a book that's a beautiful book that he just wrote and published called Sweet Myrtle and Bitter Honey, The Mediterranean Flavors of Sardinia. Well, welcome, Aficio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yes.
And,
now,
thanks for promoting also Sardinia.
Yeah.
Well, we went there. We were talking to you before we came on the air, and we went there, I think, about 12 years ago, and we really enjoyed the beauty of the scenery. Anne was bemoaning the fact that we didn't meet as many Sardinians as we would have liked, so we didn't sample many of the taste treats that are in your book. No, although there are some taste treats that I think we might avoid, like that wonderful cheese that's filled with maggots.
No, I think I'll skip them. I eat most anything, Aficio, but I will pass on the ripe cheese. What's it called? Rotten cheese.
Right.
Yeah, and also the other one is I've never gotten my head around eels, so I know that's a specialty. But you have many other things. Pardon?
That hard to catch.
Oh, good, because I'm not about to just scramble around for them.
They're hard to catch, and then you roast them alive on spits, and it all sounds just a shade barbaric.
But Sardinia is an old, maybe it's like me, it's an old soul, like, you know, it's an old country, it's an old ancient. So it has, and through the years, and through, it has preserved, I will say, through the generations, has preserved traditions, because Sardinia has a lot of traditions. And, you know, eating certain types of cheese, I will say that it takes time, you know. And it takes time. You have to go more than one time to Sardinia. But I can guarantee one thing, that anybody that goes to Sardinia, anybody that tastes the flavors of Sardinia, or even the hospitality of a Sardinian person, will never forget, and will the next opportunity will just really grab it and go for. So, you know, that's what I try to do with my wife here and my team of people here in America, to bring Sardinia a little more closer, and maybe to even prepare an audience so that they can travel, so they can enjoy a little more this island.
Yeah,
no, it's
I mean,
one. I wish
certainly
we
enjoy it more.
Yeah.
If I could consult with you about it.
Yeah, I mean, I wish we'd read this book before we went, because it's a combination of an introduction
history,
of the cuisine and the traditions and the history, and at the same time it's a travelogue that
personal
says
personal memoir.
Yeah.
You know, the seasons to go because of the various festivals.
I mean, we thought we were very smart because we learned a few things. We learned that the best red wine in Sardinia was Cannonau Oliena, and then we found out that it was the grape was really the same as the Grenache or Garnacha that's grown in Spain, and that's because it was brought there under Spanish dominance of the island.
Yeah.
And so that, you pick up all that and you sort of piece it together and you get more of a feeling of the place. I think that perhaps one of the things that that we didn't realize, but I'm sure you can speak to, is that because Sardinia was invaded so much over the years, I think the, you know, the people were inward-looking and suspicious of strangers, and maybe that's taking some, maybe that's breaking down now, but the further away you are from the coast, the more of that you're going to find. Does that make sense?
Definitely. I would like to also, you know, point that you already been there once, which that makes our conversation easier and more exciting. But don't be afraid, after this book and after our gourmet Sardinia products that we have here, all our restaurants, you know, to go back one more time, because you will enjoy and you will be able to really see all the different layers of, like you said, all the different invaders that they came and they left a little bit, and we integrated in our culture and made ours, those ingredients.
You know, I think that Sicily had the same history of constantly being overrun by foreign invasions, but I think that Sardinia maintained a fierce independence at longer than actually did Sicily.
Oh, well, Sicily was totally—I mean, it was totally overrun by the Romans. And then it was totally overrun by several other people afterwards.
But Sardinia also was held as under various city states for a long time, right?
Oh yes, I mean Sardinia—you start the Carthaginians, the Romans, the Phoenicians.
Just in case you didn't get that first bit, that's the Carthaginians, that's Hannibal and his crew.
Yeah, they had elephants.
Yes, they were elephants there.
Yeah. That's why, yeah, exactly, the Vandals. I mean, it was really, being an island so far away from the mainland, was able to keep all these traditions from father to son, and really maintain its integrity. And that was something that frightened me, and it kind of inspired me, and it pushed me to really put together this book, and because my generation is pretty much the one that I always like to say, you know, I saw the black and white generation. Everything you see right now is in color. Everything you see right now is beautiful, arranged, and you don't see anything that I saw when I was growing up.
What did you see when you were growing up?
I saw, it was totally different. I mean, my town was self-contained, so we didn't have any cars. We didn't go anywhere
else. No, I see what you mean, yes.
So everything you see was like family exchange of four seasons, exchange of products, meat for cheese. My grandfather used to go with the two ox, you know, and just travel for weeks and come back with something that it wasn't, you know, around. It was totally different life. Now you just put your fingers and you got everything you want anywhere.
Okay, so even in relatively remote Sardinia, it's not quite as isolated as it used to be.
Absolutely, no way. I mean,
when we were there,
in the summertime, you have yachts everywhere.
Yeah,
you have airplanes.
Well, I told Peter I'd never go back to the Costa Smeralda unless he took me by boat and my yacht.
So we're going back there soon. You can tell. But I've been looking at your book, and I have to admit that I'm inspired to go back. So if we see you at the Fancy Food Show in New York, I'm going to try and take you aside for a few minutes, and we'll conspire about what kind of Sardinian adventure we might be able to create. Because, listeners, you could do this on your own from this book, because there's so much detail in there about all the different regions and all the different flavors. But we're going to cheat, and we're going to get a first-hand recommendation. Listeners, I can't promise you that Ficio is going to be able to respond to all of your emails and all of your telephone calls helping you to do that. But after we go, I promise we'll bring all the information back and we'll make it available to you.
Ficio, could you just talk briefly about the title, the sweet myrtle and bitter honey, the two ingredients that you felt were symbolic enough to title your book after them.
But there is a little bit of romance, and also the fact that those two are really almost unique to the island of Sardinia, definitely to the Mediterranean. But in Sardinia, we cook with those ingredients. We enjoy those two ingredients, and they're so unique. And so, you know, the myrtle we roast, and also with the myrtle, the perfume, the smell of the island is like, especially in the warm summers, you know, when the smell is in the air, you will smell these herbs like myrtle. And then the bitter honey is so unique and so medicinal, so unique when you use it in a dessert or in a shrimp sauce or and it just brings you back. I mean, every time I taste those flavors, I close my eyes and I see my land.
Like abamele.
Yeah.
That's honey and pollen reduction. Sounds wonderful.
The abamele is another very ancient and unique to the island of Sardinia, and we are the only people that brings it to this country. And it's having such a great success because we use it in a different way. Originally, they were like used only for like a dip, you know, like a chicory, like something, bitter herbs, like very wild, or some fruits, or maybe vegetables. But today, in the cuisine that we use it, like with some buffalo mozzarella, prosciutto, I mean, you drizzle a little bit of abamele, and it's fantastic. Or with some roast peaches, really, it brings you, the pollen, you know, reduction is what kind of gives you very unique flavor.
Now, Anne was saying earlier on, Fizio, I understand that you're making it possible for people to get these ingredients, which are so important to the cuisine. Can you explain how listeners can do that?
We created a company here based in Texas. It took a couple of years to put it together because I had to put my family and friends, small producers in Sardinia, which they label unique and staples, I will say, of this Sardinian cuisine. I call them like a Sardinian pantry. And from olive oil to pasta, fregola, and those sauces, we put it together under the label Gourmet Sardinia. And we have a website.
Go ahead, please.
www.gourmetsardinia.com. And you can just click on and just go and we ship it overnight. So it's really Americanized, really a good style service. We're very service oriented.
But it gives you the same pantry then as that's called for in this book.
Oh yes, and so that you can make all those recipes, because otherwise you won't be able. Since some of these recipes are so specific to the ingredients, and like you know what a botarga is, for example.
Yeah. Oh no, sure, yes,
the fish roe.
Now, could you please tell me? Everybody in the world loves botarga except me. Now, what is? Have I just said the wrong kind?
No, and you know maybe you had the tuna botarga, which I rather start you with a gray mullet botarga, which is a little milder, not so fishy, not so salty, and definitely you need to have a good kind, you know.
I mean, it's on everything in Spain.
But there are flavors. Those are flavors that people need to get acquainted to, because they're so new and so, I wouldn't even say strong, but they're so almost rustic.
Acquired. Yeah.
They're, you know, they're like rustic, so they're new. You're not used to that flavor unless you're really... I always challenge people, usually in the summertime when I go there with my family, always somebody comes from the States, and they, you know, and I can see their faces the first time, you know, is a really, because it's a new flavor, but even the Japanese cuisine gives you that. It gives that to people.
I mean, I like a lot of unusual flavors. I have that, reduction, what is it, the, not sardine, what is it, the
mosto reduction?
No, the Anchovies.
Oh, the anchovies.
Anchovies reduction. And everybody said it was an acquired taste. I love it. I put it on some greens from the garden, and I just loved it.
So then if you like that, you definitely can be able to enjoy a little bit of botarga, maybe with some greens or just the spaghetti.
They shave it all over spaghetti in Spain, I know.
But anyway, if people need to get a fix of Sardinian cuisine, after all they have to do is buy a plane ticket to either Dallas or Houston, and you'll take care of them, right?
Hopefully next year, of course. I'm working on the full circle, so we're gonna have a small hotel with about 20 to 25 rooms, with a restaurant and a cooking classes. So a cooking school in Sardinia, which
is my town. Great.
I was saying, sign us up for that, would you?
So we'll keep you informed, and then...
Oh, I'm up for that one. I'll even try Grand Prix again. I had that too in Sardinia.
So when I'm there, I will go there in the summer, like 3-4, maybe especially in the springtime and fall, that's when it's beautiful. I will tell people that I'm working and act like I'm working. Instead, I will be enjoying.
Well, Afiso, as I said, sign us up for that trip as soon as you get that organized. And I'm ready. And
good.
I think that Rabideau is ready too.
Yeah, I was just sneaking a look at the menu at that restaurant I was talking to you about in Sydney, and he's got stracci di pasta con ragu di coniglio e fave novelle.
Rabbit.
That's good.
But the rabbit's braised. He says it's braised in myrtle.
Which we
now know is myrtle leaves.
Yeah,
myrtle leaves or myrtle liqueur, because with the berries.
Oh, I see. Okay, so
it makes liqueur also.
Myrtle
okay.
Liqueur.
Yeah.
And he's got Malarida Sala Zafferano.
Oh, I was going to ask you about that.
The San Gavino con vongole, bottega e fiore di zucca.
Oh, we're
bravo.
Going there, aren't we?
There is that recipe, close to that recipe in my book.
Exactly.
Okay, well, I'm sure. So he's doing traditional things, but he's doing it with ingredients which are unique to the country that he's made home. So
exactly.
So we're hoping to catch up with him, and if we succeed in doing that, we'll make sure that we know how we can get in touch with you. So we're going to go to a break shortly, but if you can hang on the line, what we'll do is we'll get a direct email address for you so we can make that connection.
Great.
And now, a last thought about your wonderful country of Sardinia. Do you have a last thought for our listeners?
One more time?
One last thought for our listeners.
Well, one last thing you'd like to tell them about Sardinia.
About Sardinia? about some good pecorino when you go there. don't
for
forget.
Sure. Pecorino and
some good pecorino with some pane carasau. With the typical bread and a glass of wine. It doesn't get better than that.
It doesn't get any better.
And now, what are we going to do?
Yes, well, we're going to thank Afisio, and hopefully we'll be in touch. And now we have to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we have another guest on the line now, Amy Felder, who is a certified executive pastry chef and an author. We're going to talk about her latest book, which is called Savory Sweets. And isn't that enticing to think of savory sweets? It's my kind of sweets, savory sweets.
But she's also a teacher, and I can tell you from reading this book, I think she must be a very good one.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, if you want to really learn what she's explaining to you, listeners, you get this book. And she knows. She teaches and she communicates, and she's actually teaching at the College of Culinary Arts and for Johnson & Wales University in Charlotte, North Carolina. And that's a whole big mouthful of stuff, Amy, but welcome.
Well, thank you so much. It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Now, I said to you off air that it's really so dense in information, this book, and it has so many concepts to convey. And you explained to me, you think of it as three books. Do you want to describe how you envision this book?
Yeah, if I could maybe just describe that it's an outgrowth of classes I've taught where we're just trying to get students to look at taste and flavor in a critical fashion. And so certainly the first part of the book is that. It's establishing a vocabulary for analyzing taste and flavor. And there are some charts and graph type of visualizations in there as well, so students can go through exercises and be able to really write down what they're experiencing to get them beyond I like it or I don't like it. The second part of the book is certainly how to apply these in desserts, in play desserts in particular, using culinary cooking techniques. And then the third part of the book is really a resource guide of merging the culinary and the pastry world so that you could look up, for instance, basil or Vidalia onion or carrot and see all the different flavors that go with it and
dill.
How to apply it.
I'm looking at dill.
Oh, yeah.
That
absolutely.
Goes with everything. I yeah. never thought of it.
Well, it's surprising how much of these flavors really go with everything.
Chocolate, Amy? Dill yeah. with chocolate? It's just white chocolate, right?
Just white chocolate, yeah.
Well, now, hold on a second, though. We were talking just now, this is Peter, of course, we were talking just now about students, but our listeners, while they're interested in food, mm-hmm. they're not really students in the in the sense of the children or the young people that you teach.
Right.
But I think this book's important to people who enjoy eating and want to extract maximum pleasure from it. Don't you think? I mean, because
yeah.
understanding taste and why taste and what taste is all about and the fact that smell is an important part of taste. All of this is very important to the enjoyment of food for everybody, I think. Don't you think?
Absolutely, Peter. And I also think that it's a great way that when you have these tools, you know, how many times have you made something and tasted it and thought to yourself, I know it needs something,
yes,
but I'm not 100% sure where to go next. And I think that once you start really becoming a critical taster, you're able to answer that question much easier.
Well, see, I just ask Anne. I say, what? I know this sauce needs something.
Right.
But what is it? I don't know whether it's lemon juice, or I don't know whether it's
usually
more wine,
salt or lemon juice.
I don't know if it's more salt and pepper.
Right.
I just, when it doesn't turn out quite like I'd like it to, I just say, sweetheart, taste this and tell me what it needs. And somehow or other, she seems to know. So obviously I need to study this book a little
there
more carefully than she does.
Now, and we were telling you that we first encountered this idea that smell is absolutely essential to taste.
Mm-hmm.
When we were interviewing Heston Blumenthal at the Fat Duck in Bray, England,
yep.
And in his demonstration, you hold your nose so you can't smell it, and you taste it, and you can't see it, of course.
Right.
And so you're blindfolded as well, and you taste an apple, and you don't taste an apple.
Where did he conjure up the apple from? I mean, he produced an apple out of nowhere.
I don't know where.
But he had, I mean, he didn't just tell us about it. He actually had us do it, and
right.
it was absolutely astounding. But what are the statistics? I mean, you have how many taste buds, and then you have how many taste sensors, and then smell adds even more. Give our listeners the numbers.
Well, I think that the best number is to know that we can, you know, think about that we are perceiving four or five different tastes on our tongue, and yet we can perceive hundreds of thousands of aromas. And so we can perceive, and then think about your dog or your cat that's perceiving millions of, you know, different kinds of aroma. But for us, all those subtle nuances that we only really get through smell are lost. You know, how many times have you had a cold and you're eating or you're cooking and you're like, I can't taste the thing?
Right.
That's because you're plugged up.
Now, of course, I don't know that it helps cats. One day I was stressed out and absentmindedly nibbling, and it turned out I was nibbling on cat food, and it didn't taste very good. It was meow mix. It was not good.
No, I thought you were going to tell the story about how the one time when you grated fresh horseradish.
Oh, my cats.
And the cats just went berserk.
They absolutely went berserk.
They jumped from the top of my kitchen cabinets all the way up.
And ran away. Howled and ran away. I thought there was another very interesting, at least I think it's in this book, because Anna's always told me that one of the huge advantages of fat in cooking is that fat makes things taste good.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you seem to say something, I mean, it doesn't contradict it, but it's a sort of different viewpoint. You said that fat actually masks flavors.
Right. I mean,
can you jump in the middle of that for me?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no, as a pastry chef, there's no doubt that I'm going to tell you that fat makes things taste good. On the other hand, if you think about, you know, your papilla on your tongue and your taste buds as those bumps on your tongue, let's just if we can visualize that. And the more fat you're ingesting, think about a Ben and Jerry's ice cream, the more you're coating those bumps so that it's just taking longer for your taste buds to perceive the flavor.
And it's also cold for the ice cream. That's another.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. If you've ever had like a chocolate sorbet versus a chocolate ice cream and chocolate sorbet being water-based, I mean, you just get such an intense pow of chocolate flavor that you won't ever get from the ice cream. And it's not that one's better or worse, really. It's just that it's something to be aware of.
But Amy, now you're right on trend here because this blending of the savory and the sweet is very au courant at the moment. Mm. We've gone to like Pong in New York, mm-hmm. where it's a pastry chef opening a restaurant,
right.
which is a dessert restaurant, but it also has savories.
Right.
And why is it? Why for centuries now people were able to have sweets and savories separated? Why are they now fusing?
That's a really good question. I was just in New York at Sam Mason's Tailor.
Oh, I don't you love him?
Oh, I have to say, I can still close my eyes and taste all the courses. It was just incredible. And he's, to me, that was like the perfect quintessential merging of the two worlds. And
Have any cocktails with Evan Freeman?
Of course I did.
Did you have his solids?
I had there were two different ones we had, and now I'm not going to remember the name. I just remember that they were exquisite.
Oh, can we go there, Abbott, when we're in New York in June?
Well, of course we can. I mean, we can go anywhere.
I think you better start working
at least
now.
At least in the planning stages, we can go anywhere. I'm supposed to start working on it already.
Yes.
I have London and... I have
right.
London and Milan
right.
to do before yeah. I can do my...
And what did you just say, Amy, about...
New York.
I think that, you know, if a pastry chef is really looking for different types of flavor and flavor that maybe is more of a full plate profile that really has a top, middle, and base note. I mean, if you use the wine analogy, you know, we've all had the glass of wine that tastes really good at first and then just kind of dissipates and you feel like you're kind of falling off a cliff.
Yes.
And I think many desserts have been like that traditionally, with really sweet top notes, and then when you swallow, you're just kind of left there.
Yes.
And I think that especially pastry chefs who are coming from, and many of these pastry chefs are coming from working in restaurants, not working in pastry shops, or they're working side by side with culinary, and certainly that's my background, that once you start looking at their toolkit of ingredients, you start saying, well, wait a minute, why are we not using some of those ingredients?
Right.
And once you start using them, you realize that that's how you get these beautiful flavors that just, you know, entertain you from top to bottom, and when you swallow, you still feel like there's something happening in your mouth.
Do you have an example of this? And so you can actually point out top, middle, and low or bottom.
A base note? The example I could give you would be an example that is not a new example, but that comes from the Mayans and the history of chocolate from, you know, a trillion years ago, would be the whole idea of adding ancho chili to chocolate. And if you think about now, of course, our chocolate is sweetened, and at that time it wasn't. But for now, if we're making a dark chocolate mousse with ancho chili or some kind of hot pepper, that you have the beginning note is the sweet from the chocolate. The middle note is just the chocolate essence, that wonderful, fatty, smooth richness. And then the base note would be just that wonderful, kind of slightly drying feeling from the pepper, and because it's been roasted, and the heat from the pepper as well. And then that way you just kind of... Think about it kind of as music that has harmony to it rather than just one note playing
that
straight through.
That sounds great.
And that in your mouth, you can really feel that in your mouth, that you kind of have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And once you get there, that's food that's really delightful.
And how do we also move from like a piece of pie to a plated dessert?
Well, I would be the first to say that I'm not really probably making a lot of plate desserts for my family at home. It's probably more of a special occasion thing. But I think that you could easily, if you're having a piece of pie, so you maybe add a scoop of ice cream to that or add some caramel sauce to that apple pie.
My family always had the apple pie hot with cheddar cheese on top.
There you go.
My
family's done that as well because I'm from Wisconsin.
Well, see, in England, they do that with fruitcake. with the wonderful raisin sultana, kind of fruitcake
they
that we have at Christmas.
Day.
No, you have a piece of cheddar cheese on the side.
Oh my! I've never heard of
this.
My mother always used to serve it that way.
Wow.
I don't think that they were sophisticated in savory sweets like you are. I don't know where the idea came from. Certainly radical adventures in cuisine was not something that they were involved in at all, I can assure you.
No, but his family is so big, and I think it's just an English taste that his one cousin went to dessert camp.
Oh my gosh.
She ate dessert for a week. Their birthday cakes and wedding cakes are all fruit cakes.
They're covered with marzipan and
fondant.
Usually hard icing. Not that funny soft icing that they put on cakes over here.
Yeah.
If people are looking for a starting point, now we've got them all. We've got our listeners all excited about putting green beans in their apple pie. where are some good starting points?
I think there are a couple of different ways to start. I think one way to start is with something, a basic dessert that you know that you really like. So let's say one way I started was with my mom's gingerbread cake recipe, which is like a dense, moist, gingery cake that I grew up with. All my childhood, we ate that. And then start looking at what other flavors would go with that. And so my feeling was, well, I would really like to try something kind of earthy and heavy spice with that. And to me, I thought of cumin. So I started serving cumin ice cream with a gingerbread cake, and people really liked it. That's one way to start. Another way to start is pick, especially, as we're getting into the spring and summer, pick what is in season. Pick the herb in the farmer's market or the herb that's in your garden that looks absolutely incredible, and just start going from there. So maybe you're used to using mint. Basil is botanically related to mint. Chances are anything that goes with mint, basil is going to go along with really well, too. That's another way to start. So there are a couple different ways to get into the room, I guess.
Of course, you have this section on balsamic vinegar, and it really depends on what balsamic, you use.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, we have one balsamic that would cost a fortune even in Moden, and we sort of meet it out with an eyedropper just about. And now that goes really well with ice cream and
berries,
heated figs or persimmons or something like that.
Now the interesting thing is
you couldn't use it for salad.
Amy, recipe. This balsamic was 40 years old when we bought it, and it's almost 50 years old now.
Oh,
and it's absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
Coffee and tea are coming into vogue too with desserts, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think with everything, with the balsamics, with the coffee and tea. I mean, the thing where I get kind of alternately excited and frustrated as a chef is there's so much to learn and so much more to know, and there's always new stuff coming out. And so I guess I would suggest people do what I do, which is just taste.
Oh, no. We should all be so lucky.
Well, now let's navigate a little further through savory sweets help our listeners understand how it's organized so they get, because it's like an instruction manual, and you did things in a certain order for that reason. So we started off talking about the basics of what is taste and all that kind of stuff. So take us a little bit further into the book and go over some of the sections with us, if you would.
Okay, well, with the taste, and I think that the taste section, the vocabulary section, could be used for not just for savory sweets or desserts, but certainly could be used for wine tasting as well. And the whole idea of having a plate profile with a top, middle, and base note, and what compromises those particular notes, and how to taste things, to notice if there's a top, middle, or base note. And again, that kind of relates to what we were saying about is tasting something and if Anne's not there to know if something's missing or not, that knowing where the top, middle, and base note are can help you. I personally think that one of the most helpful sections of the book is the section that's the largest, which is the resource section, so that you could just look up an ingredient and it would have all the companion ingredients to it. So let's say you have a lot of
fresh
basil.
Okay, so sort of like a goes with.
Yes, the goes with section, so that you could look up basil and it would tell you some ideas of how to use it, and then it would also have, the all the food it goes with, the vegetables, the nuts, the baking spices, if it goes with chocolate or not. Kind of goes down the whole line. Gives you an idea of a plate of dessert for each one with a drawing to kind of give you a visualization. And then the very last section, there are eight actual plates that were kind of use everything from the other sections in it, if that makes sense. So they talk about plate profiles, they have recipes and talk about the ingredients and the cooking style.
Okay, so
and they're pretty ambitious.
So having sort of gone to school, then you sort of get to put it all together.
Yes, absolutely.
And then you get the color photographs, which makes you eager to do that.
I must confess, we read lots and lots of books. We talk to lots and lots of authors. So I might be getting you confused with someone else, but are you the person who really likes beets?
Yes.
I just came across that.
Yeah.
I love beets.
I have to tell you a funny story. It's actually been on the air before, so listeners, humor me here. But we met Sarah Moulton several times, and mm-hmm. on one occasion she was demonstrating, and for some reason, out of the blue, she said, "I hate beets." and we thought that was very odd, because first of all, we very much like beets.
Right.
And she went on to say, what? And I said, "Can you explain why?" from the audience. And she said, "They taste like dirt."
Ah.
Well, I mean, I think they taste very good. I mean, I think they taste earthy, but yes. I don't think they necessarily taste a whole like dirt. But you really like them. Explain why you really like them.
Because I love that earthiness of them, and they're very sweet. They caramelize beautifully. They roast amazing, and you just can't deny they're very happy, exciting color, which I really like as well. But I think that kind of earthy, dirty, robust flavor can go really well. I mean, it can go really well with citrus. It can go really well with things that are acidic, like buttermilk. I pair it in the book, I think, with a chocolate cake and orange panna cotta, and that goes really well. I like the unexpected, and I like that if you sell somebody a dessert and say, "Well, this is beet, you know, I'm making you a beet cake tonight, honey," they may not be so excited about trying it. But I think if you just give it to people, they're going to taste it and say, I mean, the best compliment I can get is, "Wow, I've never tasted anything quite like this." And they don't need to necessarily know that there are beets in there.
Yeah,
that's wonderful. Now here's a test for you on the fly. And bought beets the other day. We hadn't had beets for ages, so we did roast some beets, and they were really quite delicious. But at the same time at the store, she also bought parsnips. So what are we going to do with parsnips?
Oh, that is a hard one. You know why? Because parsnips are so starchy. I would probably make parsnip chips out of it. I would slice them really thin.
Yeah.
Maybe simmer them in a little simple syrup just to get them a little softened and infused with sugar.
Okay, all right.
Maybe sprinkle a little bit, take them out of the simple syrup, sprinkle just the smallest bit of sea salt on top, and bake them in a really low oven. And then you'd have like a sweet and salty parsnip chip.
That's
awesome.
And you could serve it with maybe some kind of mascarpone ginger cheese spread. Or
that's another
that
good workhorse, mascarpone
yeah.
cheese.
Because we just happen to have all of these things hiding in our refrigerator.
I'll be over later then. That sounds good.
Amy, well, listen, this is a fascinating book, a fascinating approach. Is this an auxiliary course, or do they, I mean, is this your basic course?
It's for us, it's not. It's one of the courses in the bachelor four-year degree program. But pieces of this are in every course, because you can't really teach culinary without teaching about taste and flavor. So I think that this is where a couple years ago it was something kind of a little bit very modern and kind of out there. Now it's becoming more and more mainstream.
I think
and
so too.
I'm seeing that at school as well.
Yeah, on the menu, listeners, this is a fascinating new departure for you. Another arrow in your cooking quiver, if you might say, that you can surprise all your friends.
Another arrow in your quiver.
There you go.
I
could have said another bullet in your gun, but I really don't believe in that kind of thing. So, Amy, it was so wonderful of you to join us today.
Well,
and
thank you so much,
listeners. Poor old Amy's been suffering from a telephony outage. so we should certainly pray with her that she actually gets telephone service back, so that she can communicate. Get properly. She's calling us from the office because she doesn't have a choice. thank you so much for joining us. The book is called Savory Sweets by Amy Felder. It's available through the bookshelf portion of the On the Menu website. It is a good opportunity to remind you that you can look at all the resources that we've assembled for you at www.onthemenuradio.com.
And you can also check in with us next week.
Well, you can send us an email in between. If you like, if you get lonely, send an email to onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com and we'll be sure to get it. And if we like what you say, we'll reply to you. If we don't, we won't.
And we'll be here again next week.
Same time, same place at www.onthemenuradio.com. So thank you for joining us, and we hope you'll come back next week, same time, same place.
Bye-bye.